everyone, you're listening to Operation Dichotomy. I'm Paul, I'm your host, and we are the bridge between perception and reality. If you've listened to us before and you've kept up with our podcast, I do want to thank you for your continued support. If you haven't subscribed yet to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify or wherever else you listen to podcasts, please go ahead and do so. Don't forget to leave us a positive review if we left you anything of value. Connect with us online at operationdichotomy.com so you don't miss out on any cool stuff that's going on, like today's interview that I get to have with an awesome guest. So without further ado, let me begin by introducing who we have here today. I actually have the privilege of getting to sit here in his house and interviewing this man. If you don't know who he is, I'll tell you. He is the co-host of the MFCEO Project podcast with Andy Frisella. If you don't know who that is or what that is, I highly advise you to go listen to it. If you had to pick one between his and mine, I would sadly say go listen to his because it provides way more value, which actually is coming to an end now, right?
Fairly soon, yeah.
Oh, man. So that's going to be sad. So listen to it. The good stuff is all there. He is an accomplished writer. He's a mentor, speaker. Some would call him coach, I believe. He's a man of many nicknames. Of all of them, my favorite, and I think the original that will stick forever, is the Pastor of Disaster. He's a husband, a father of soon-to-be four daughters, which I assume will be very crazy. He's a former Baptist pastor turned devout Catholic. He's an overall great human being, and he's actually had a lot of personal impact on me, which I'll probably share about in a little bit. But without further ado, today we have the Pastor of Disaster, Vaughn Kohler.
Thanks, Paul.
Oh, man.
It's good to be here, man. I have a good friend named Zach, and he and I are super close, and there's a word that we use that not everybody knows, just to describe when you meet somebody, you really resonate with them, it's we're simpatico. Have you ever heard that term?
Yeah, I have.
We're simpatico. So I feel like you and I are simpatico. So I think we resonate with each other. We kind of understand where we're getting from, you know? Mm-hmm. And growing up in a small town in Kansas that's, you know, predominantly white, yeah. I would have said, Paul's my Asian friend.
We'll talk about that too.
Yeah, right.
And Vaughn's my white guy, buddy. Yeah. Oh, man. But I don't know if I ever told you this. Let me just tell you, because I think it transitions into what we want to talk about. If you weren't on the MFCEO project as a co-host, I don't think I would have heard the podcast at all. And I don't think I would be who I am today because of that transition that happened. So MFCEO, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's kind of categorized as a business entrepreneurship podcast. But in my notes, I also put life ? Podcast, because it really is about how you live your life and what you want to get out of your own life. So it's an excellence podcast.
Yeah.
Be good at anything, go for it. That being said, it's led by a man named Andy Frisella. If you don't know who he is, go look him up. He is a, let's call him a rough around the edges, very raw person. He'll tell you the truth. Like, he's never going to sugarcoat anything, so don't expect it.
Yeah.
Because of that, many people are offended by who he is, and they don't get to see who the heart of who he is. And that, again, that keeps him away.
Right.
And that probably would have kept me away had he been the only one hosting the show, because that's kind of who I was. What drew me into the show was the other end of that spectrum was this dude named Vaughn Kohler, the Pastor of Disaster. And immediately I was like, well, this guy's a former Baptist pastor. I forget what episode, but there was one episode where you were saying something and instead of saying the word hell, you actually spelled out H-E-W hockey stick. Like, dude, are you serious? Like, what's going on? But the whole point of what I'm making here is this crazy dynamic of this loud, brash dude. And then there's this pastor. How is it that they could be on the same page of whatever's going on in this podcast? And that is what allowed me to stay. Mm-hmm. And that's also what began to shift my perspective and help me to see that I was living in a bubble, essentially.
Yeah.
Which was the birth of this whole podcast and movement in the first place, which is my long way of saying thank you.
Yeah, you bet. No, it's been surreal. And Andy and I just had a wonderful conversation about this, because when we announced that we were, you know, doing the last episode of the podcast, we've gotten some pretty, hopefully this is, express this gratitude, not bragging, but we got some pretty crazy DMs basically saying, you know, we over the last couple of years, we've always gotten lots of emails and DMs and texts and stuff saying how the podcast has helped people. But I think with the realization that we were finishing it all kind of came out. And Andy has literally had people tell him, I was going to commit suicide, and I came across the podcast, and it helped turn my life around. We've had a number of people talk about how it pulled them out of the dumps, and he and I were talking about that, and we were saying that we really did capture this really, really unusual, compelling convergence of, you know, the fire-breathing South County redneck business genius mm-hmm. meets the somewhat conservative former Baptist pastor turns Catholic, and that coming together formed like this catalyst of just a unique conversational this conversational dynamic mm-hmm. that is just really unique. Yeah. And he and I talked about, you know, without going into detail, we got some other things planned. You know, we got some other things that we're going to do together that I think are going to be really good. But hopefully we did provide a model for people that is really in keeping with your mission mm-hmm. of you don't have to be cookie cutter versions of each other to get along and to share the same values. And so that to me is something that is an enduring lesson of the MFCEO project.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that was shown from the top down. And again, that's pretty much why I'm here and why I have this opportunity to interview you in the first place.
Yeah. So it was. You bet. Well, thank you, because I love any way that we can impact people and encourage you to pursue your mission.
Awesome. And we're going to talk about that as well. But one of the first things that I wanted to ask you about, because the world kind of knows you, and including myself, I see you as sort of an experiential expert on the faith and excellence dynamic. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that dynamic exists in the first place, or we'll call it a dichotomy, is because somewhere in culture or somewhere in our society that we live in right now says that if you are a faithful person, and by faith I mean religion, well, let's call it a religious belief in a higher being for now, mm-hmm. then by believing in that faith, you are foregoing this level of work ethic and excellence that some people have if they don't have faith. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of that spectrum is the, let me work my butt off in everything that I do, pursue excellence, and just neglect the spiritual, faithful aspects of the quote-unquote other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like now following what you've been talking about and what you've really stood for these past years, your message, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is very much that these things overlap. Mm-hmm. We may not always see the way that it overlaps, but they for sure overlap and they need each other.
Right.
And because I feel like you've become this expert as a culmination of the life that you lived, can you tell us a little bit about who you were before meeting Andy and before making the transition out of?
Yeah, so I mean, I felt called to the ministry like in 1993. I finished my schooling at Wheaton College, which is a very excellent Christian college, committed to high standards. Then I went to seminary, went off to to start my ministry in Manhattan, Kansas, which is where Kansas State University is. And I would say that, you know, I was a good person, a good Christian. I love people. I think I've always, for whatever reason, had a real gift for empathizing with people, seeing where they're coming from. So I've always been good with people on some level. And I think God has given me some natural talents in terms of communication, in terms of kind of understanding where people are coming from. And so I kind of rode those natural talents, and I rode some of that sort of basic Christian virtue mm-hmm. for 10 years. And I think that God is so gracious that He did bless the ministry. He did do good things through that. But all that time, I had no idea that I really had some pretty, I'll use the phrase, half-assed standards for myself. Mm-hmm. Because there were aspects of the Bible and the Christian message that I never even really noticed. There were different ways in which I could have been far more excellent. I could have been far more disciplined. I could have been far more fierce and aggressive. And those weren't necessarily virtues that I thought were Christian virtues.
Why?
I don't know. I think even though I studied the scripture, I had the misconception that I think a lot of people have, mm-hmm. which is that Jesus is just this nice guy. Okay, Jesus is not a nice guy. Jesus is love incarnate, but Jesus, when the moment called for it, He used a whip to clean out the temple because people were using it for hypocritical reasons. He had very strong words for those who thought that they were better than everybody else and didn't need God. He used in his teaching, in his parables, he used sarcasm. He used parts of speech that we would consider something that, you know, like, what's his name from the Late Show, Stephen Colbert. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of sort of acerbic, sarcastic figures of speech or rhetorical devices. Jesus didn't play, okay? And, you know, to use the famous, if anybody's familiar with C.S. Lewis and his writings, there's a fictional story called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in which these little kids are about to meet the great Lion King for the first time, and they ask Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, oh, he's a lion, is he safe? And the beaver's like, safe, of course he's not safe, but he's good. Mm-hmm. He's the good king. And I think that most of our views of Jesus is that he's just like Mr. Rogers hanging on a cross, and he's nice, and he shares these fortune cookie little guru type statements. And they don't realize, no, this is not a person to be messed with. Mm-hmm. He's very serious. He loves people. He takes them where they're at, but he loves them too much to leave them the way they're at. Mm-hmm. He transforms them. And sometimes that transformation is really, really painful. And I mean, what people a lot of times don't even know about the Jesus of the New Testament, the Jesus of the Gospels, is that Jesus spoke about money and hell more than anything else. Now, there was always a context, and ultimately he did extend incredible mercy to people. But for whatever reason, even though I studied that again and again and again, mm-hmm. it didn't click for me. It clicked. I had a view of Jesus and Christian life that was more almost like the Victorian era of be polite, don't rock the boat, have a certain really buttoned up standard of morality. That was kind of my sense of Christianity. And what happened was, for various reasons, I left the ministry. Nothing, no scandalous reason, but I left the ministry in part because I studied and chose to become Catholic. But also because even if that wouldn't have happened, I had already planned to go into working at a college because I love college students. And so I wanted to be a professor of writing and speaking. Mm-hmm. But that's not what turned out, you know. God had other plans. Mm-hmm. And so we moved to St. Louis. I came into contact with this fire-breathing business genius named Andy Frisella. We hit it off.
How did that happen?
So when we first moved to St. Louis, my wife started in private practice. She was a family physician. And I started, long story short, I had wanted to start my own business as a ghostwriter. I hadn't fully gotten that off the ground. So I also worked for a local magazine that was trying to be kind of a GQ for St. Louis. Mm-hmm. But they were also adding sort of a virtue component to it, that they wanted to make men better men. So Andy has a very great reputation in St. Louis, not just for being this, you know, rough around the edges, fire-breathing guy, but also for being a really good dude who does a lot of good in the community and supports people and has built this amazing business. And so I was told by the guy that owned the magazine to go write an article about Andy. So I met with him, and I'm really abbreviating this whole story, but yeah. So I met with him and sat down and wrote the article, and we really hit it off kind of right from the beginning because we started talking about dogs. He had a picture of his dog Oscar on the wall. And so we really hit it off. Well, I go and write the article. It gets published. I deliver the magazine to him. He's like, dude, I love this article. You're a great writer. I said, thanks. And I said, man, you have great ideas. I said, you should write a book. And I had an agenda. Mm-hmm. And he said, I should. He said, I've learned a lot and have a lot of thoughts that I think could really help people. And I said, I do think they would help a lot of people. He said, I'm a good writer, but I just don't have the time. I said, well, you should hire a ghostwriter. And he said, okay. And I gave him a proposal. He said, let me think about it. Yeah. And I came back to him about a week later. He said, yeah, let's go for it. So what happened was we started meeting in the conference room. And my method of how I write books is I just interview people. I go really deep, ask them all sorts of questions about their thoughts. And then I use that as raw material. So what was happening is we were having these really in-depth conversations about topics about sales and customer service and building culture. And we recorded them. And he brought in his video guy, Tyler, to record his answers as we were having the conversation. And Andy decided, you know, Facebook was already around. Instagram was kind of getting off the, you know, kind of launching a little bit and getting big. And he would start to post his answers to these questions, and people started going crazy. They're like, this is such good content. Where's your podcast? Where can I listen to this? And he said, I don't even know what a podcast is. Like, he literally didn't. He thought podcast was something, like, both of us kind of thought podcast was something that just geeky tech people did.
Yeah.
And so he decided that he was going to have a podcast, and he looked at me and he said, you're going to be my co-host. I want you to be my co-host. And this is really funny, Paul, because really at the time, I'm still just kind of coming off being a pastor. And at the time I was teaching at the local Catholic seminary. I was an adjunct professor. I was teaching rhetoric, art of persuasion. And I'm like, okay, how's this going to go over if I'm in a podcast with a guy who's dropping the F-bomb every other word?
Yeah.
And I had a very, very firm belief in Andy's essential goodness, his goodness of heart. And I thought that what we would share was going to be really helpful to people. But I did wonder about the packaging a little bit. So what I did was I went to the president of the rector of the local Catholic seminary, who was very reputed to be respected by a wide variety of people, very holy man. And I told him all about it. And I said, do you think this is like scandalous? He goes, well, are you promoting immorality? I said, no. He said, so it's only the issue of like the F-bomb and the language. I said, yeah. He goes, oh, I think it's a fantastic opportunity. Oh. He said, I think you should take it. He said, and I think the saints would be proud of you. Because he said, you know, you're engaging culture.
Yeah.
You know? And I said, no, that's great. He said, Jesus and the saints would be proud of me. Mm. He didn't just say the saints. Just for you Protestants who are listening, that, you know. But no, and so we started, and it's been surreal. Like, right out of the gate, people really resonated with it. And we've been able to talk about, you know, practical things about how to build businesses and also mindset. And to, you know, occasionally we even get into cultural stuff, things that we think we need, you know, need to change about the culture. So it's been really great, and that's how that happened.
So I imagine that was the period where your quote-unquote half-assed nature from before shifted a lot into this full-ass, I don't know if that's a
way. Yeah, no, it's absolutely what happened. What happened was he, you know, as you might expect, working for a guy like Andy is pretty, see, I started as an independent contractor. And then eventually he said, you know, dude, you gotta come, we got something special, you gotta come work for me full-time. And be a point man for his personal brand. Now our team has gotten bigger since then. But I said, okay. You know, I thought about it and it made sense. And so there was some rough moments, because to my shame, I realized sort of after the fact that I am someone who pretty much has basically slidden by on talent and natural ability. And I had not developed a grit and a mental toughness and a commitment to excellence. But as this dude was pushing me, I realized that my spiritual life was getting better, which is really funny. You don't think some F-bomb dropping entrepreneur empire builder is going to have that kind of positive effect on your spiritual life, but it was, because I was becoming more disciplined. I was becoming more focused. I was becoming more structured with my time. I would even say that people who maybe don't have a faith background won't understand this struggle, but sometimes there is a tendency for religious people to be spiritual perfectionists. And so I literally, when I was in college, if I had my time with the Lord on Monday, but then I got busy and I let it slide and didn't spend any time with the Lord on Tuesday, I felt so guilty. I would be like, oh, well, the rest of this week is shot, so I'll just start over next week. Like, that's insane, right? Mm-hmm. But we actually had a really awesome podcast. It was called You Will Be Bad Before You're a Badass. Mm-hmm. And Andy's whole thing is you have to embrace the messy process of getting to be a master at something. And you have to be willing to just be humble and suck at something. And I literally remember at one point going, you know what? It's the same way with the spiritual life. If you start on Monday and you have a great time of prayer with the Lord, but Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you let your busyness completely overwhelm you, so what? Start again on Friday and have a great time. Like, you don't be a perfectionist. Don't be an all or nothing kind of person. Give what's inside of you, and God will bless that. And so those kinds of little lessons I was incorporating into my spiritual life. Mm-hmm. And And it was really pretty amazing. And so it made me go back into the scriptures and look at stuff. And that's when I started seeing. I mean, I had seen them, but I hadn't really seen them. Yeah. Passages like, whatever your hand chooses to do, do it with all your might, you know, in Ecclesiastes. Whatever you do, work as the Lord, not as unto men. Even in Philippians, like, keep your eyes on those who live according to the standard we gave you. You know, have heroes. Not just Jesus. Mm-hmm. Have heroes. Look at all the other people who are doing really well. Choose them as your mentors and pursue excellence. I mean, there's excellence all over the scriptures. Yeah. All over it. And again, going back to Jesus, you look at Jesus and you go, okay, this is a loving man, but this is also a fierce man, an aggressive man, a man who had a vision, who knew exactly what he wanted. And I think Christians are just afraid of transcending niceness to a love that is sometimes direct and fierce and aggressive. And so that's kind of the transformation that went on in my own life. And I'm nowhere near where I want to be, but I'm certainly better than I was 5 years ago mm-hmm. in terms of my overall commitment to excellence. And you know, it's a journey. It's just like fitness, Paul.
Yeah.
I was killing it for like the last 7 months, and like the last month, I feel like I've kind of tapered off a little bit, and I was beating myself up about it. And Andy's brother Sal's like, Vaughn, it's a journey. Well, Christianity and faith is a journey too. Sometimes you're going to be killing it, sometimes you're not, but you got to push on, and you got to develop that grit and that mental toughness that just powers you through.
Right.
You know?
So is excellence, right? Everything's
yeah.
a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. There are going to be days that even the most excellent person mm-hmm. is subpar, you know?
True. So I think that the conclusion, if there is a conclusion to this, is that it's not separate.
Right.
They are totally intertwined. If you have discipline and excellence in one area, whether it's business or even fitness, mm-hmm. you mean to say that that actually translates into other areas of your life, like
yeah.
faith.
Yeah.
So if you are excellent and work hard in some areas, it's that discipline and that work ethic that should drive things like your spirituality, whether it's religion or basic spirituality or whatever people believe, right. it should be taken as seriously as you take everything else seriously.
Right. Absolutely. And I would also say that they drive each other. Because if you really have the right view of who God is, and you see him for his greatness and his love and his mercy and his power and his holiness, you will say, okay, if this God created me and made the whole world, I want to do him proud. And my vision of who he is should drive my desire to be the best at everything I can possibly be. Mm-hmm. Because he has given me the gift of life. And if he has given me that gift, there's a parable in the scriptures about this, that if he has given me talent and treasure and resources, and I squander that, the words in the parable is, you wicked servant. Mm-hmm. I mean, he actually calls people wicked for basically half-assing their life, half-assing the resources that he gives them. And so for me, it's not just that excellence should drive faith, it's that faith should drive excellence. And so I think when people really understand the gift of life that they've been given by God, they should want to do everything they possibly can to maximize every aspect of their life. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay.
I guess the follow-up question to that is, it's multifold. So I saw your new website. I think it's new.
Yeah. I've kind of soft launched it, but yeah, it's new.
Oh, so should I tell people? Mm-hmm. That's good. Okay.
No, so, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like your specialty, again, from the beginning of this episode, is that you are someone that is able to bring these two things together both ways. So if someone is a very quote-unquote faithful person but lacks the drive and the work ethic and excellence, mm-hmm. you're able to, I guess, coach it into
yeah.
their life. But then the other perspective is that you also work with very driven individuals. And, I mean, obviously you're surrounded by very successful, driven entrepreneurs, but you're able to bring the spiritual aspect into their life as well.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, well, okay, so sometimes our strengths are often our weaknesses, right? Uh-huh. So I'm to some extent, I feel almost like I'm sharing secrets that I shouldn't share. But one of the things that I will tell you is in getting to know, so for your listeners who don't have the full background, the Arete Syndicate is a group that Andy and Ed Milet organized, is a group of elite level entrepreneurs who literally, you know, they want to build 9-figure or more businesses. They want to impact the world. They want to crush every goal they have. They want to, you know, they want to just be awesome, you know, legends on the earth, so to speak, right? And they're already very, very accomplished people. So the average person is usually fairly surprised to find out that these people struggle with self-confidence too. These people struggle with anxiety too. They are so driven that they hold themselves to standards that sometimes they beat themselves up unfairly. I think we live in a culture that the average person doesn't beat themselves enough in some ways. I mean, that can be taken to an extreme. Yeah. So I gotta be really careful how I say that. But the point is that they hold, let me put it this way. The average person doesn't hold themselves accountable enough.
Yeah. Or to a high enough standard.
Right, or to a high enough standard. These people are almost the exact opposite. They have such a high standard that sometimes they have to be reminded, you are a human being. From dust you came and dust you will return. Okay? So you need to trust that there is a God who loves you even when you don't close the deal. There's a God who loves you and is merciful even when you make a really stupid mistake. There's a God who loves you and is merciful and will make all of this work out okay. Just trust him. Okay? And so I think that's the downside of being driven and being really committed to excellence, is that if you don't have that grounding in realizing that, okay, you're worth ultimately, your worth in the market is dependent on you producing results. Mm-hmm. But your intrinsic worth as a human being is in the fact that God loves you, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you start from that, operating from that vantage point, then to me, if you really truly understand that God loves you and he's got your back, then you should have a supernatural confidence and a calmness and a peace in the midst of your productivity that will make you even more productive and even more successful, because you know that you don't have to, quote unquote, do this stuff. You get to. Mm-hmm. It's your privilege. Does that make sense, Paul?
Yeah.
Okay, so in working with these high rollers, that's usually what I want to tell them. I'm going to say, hey, guys, you got the excellence part down. Now you got to learn to embrace the fact that God loves you so that you don't drive yourself insane, and so that you also take time to smell the roses and appreciate the good things in your life so that there's some balance there, you know? Yeah. And I think that God has really, in his sovereignty, he's given me a tremendous vantage point of working very closely with these high-level people and becoming their friends and realizing, okay, you know what? These are really high achievers. They're just like everybody else. They struggle with their own self-worth sometimes, their own confidence, and that's where I come along and I say, okay, well, here's what the scripture says. Here's what God says. So take this truth, claim it for your life, and go out and kick ass, but do it in a way that is just, you're more at peace in your heart, you know?
And obviously doing good, which for the most part, they're already doing.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, and that's another thing. I mean, going to your whole dichotomy thing, which we'll jump into, is that I think that I was raised in a tradition where it was almost like, if you're not a Christian doing something in the explicit name of Jesus, you can't possibly be doing anything good.
For example, you know, being a pastor,
right,
a missionary,
right,
Mother Teresa,
right,
or none, I guess it's the
No, and that's what I've learned is different, or is that's not the truth. The truth is that there are a lot of people from different walks of life, people that you and I wouldn't even believe, we wouldn't agree with some of their major premises about the nature of life and the world, but in spite of that, we have to recognize that they're still doing good in a particular area of their life, you know? And so so that's where, and I mean, this is where I will challenge some of my evangelical friends and my Protestant friends. If you look at the very early stages of the church, a lot of the church fathers developed what's called a logos theology. Logos means word or reason or whatever, or truth. And what they basically said was, listen, we do want people to join the church. We do want people to become a part of the body of Christ, the visible body of Christ. But the reality is that God is so gracious and he is so relentlessly loving that he extends his love through a lot of different ways. And if it's true and good and beautiful, it's a good thing. And it can come, and sometimes truth and goodness and beauty comes specifically through the visible Christian church. And sometimes truth, goodness, and beauty comes through some pagan poet who happened to, you know, write a poem that extolled something really true, good, and beautiful about the universe. And so that's where I think my earlier prejudices when I was younger are kind of gone now. I recognize truth, goodness, and beauty no matter what, who says it. Whereas I think, you know, when I was 27 years old or 20 years old, I might have said it could only come from a Christian preacher. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Would you agree that that happened, like your shift in perspective happened, not just because of Andy, but because of the different perspectives and the experiences that you were to have that were outside of your Christian bubble?
Yeah, I think so. Now, in fairness to Christians, there's always a spectrum. You know that, Paul. Yeah. So there's the far spectrum that says that I'm only going to get milk from a Christian cow, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's the spectrum that I think is a more educated perception or perspective that's more consistent with the historic Christian teaching on this that says that, yes, all truth is God's truth, mm-hmm. period. Okay, doesn't mean all sources are equally valid, but it does mean that if somebody speaks truth, no matter who you are, it's truth, mm. it's goodness, it's beauty, period. So I do think that that is something that is taught within the Christian tradition, just not my Christian tradition growing up. Right. You know, I got more of that. I mean, I will say the college that I went to was awesome about that. It was awesome about basically saying, you don't have to be one niche-oriented little tradition within Christianity to speak the truth. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of ways in which sources outside the Christian bubble provide really helpful insight, you yeah. know? So, I mean, there was a Roman philosopher named Seneca in the early days of the church who had such a connection to truth that the Christians at the time actually referred to him as our friend Seneca. And he wasn't even a Christian. He wasn't even remotely a Christian. But he tapped into truth so consistently that they saw him as an ally. Mm. So, and there's been a lot of people through, you know, that way.
Yeah, I mean, never mind. I don't get too preachy. So,
yeah, yeah.
But I do have another question stemming from all of this is, I'm going to ask you because I know you have an opinion about it, mm-hmm. I think. When we talk about the way that our society is now, where mm-hmm. we are very, very divided across various different spectrums, whether it's religion, politics, race, you name it. Mm-hmm. I feel like we kind of have an idea of why that problem exists. And I've heard you and Andy talk about it a lot, but what do you think are some positive things that we can be doing as a culture to sort of push that needle in another direction? How can we make it better? How can we create and contribute to society to make it less divisive, less judgmental, less misconception, less shooting mm-hmm. in yeah. wherever.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Oh, so two things immediately come to my mind are, one, we need to have, and I think actually we need to be intentional about this. Like, I don't think being calculated means that it's not sincere or authentic, but I think there need to be more calculated public friendships between people who are very different. So like what happened recently with Ellen and George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic. Yep. That was a wonderful teaching moment for the country that, hey, you can have a far left gay comic be good friends with a conservative Christian, you know, Republican president, and it's okay. You don't have to agree with everybody or each other. You can have really positive conversations with each other and constructive relationships. So I feel like the people who are like that, and I think there are. I think there are a lot more I think there are a lot more friendships out there of radically different people politically, philosophically, morally, and I think those people need to just be far more public about their friendship and provide a model for people to follow. I have to tell you that I was really disappointed with, there was a great question. Anderson Cooper asked a great question at one of the most recent Democratic debates. And he raised the issue of Ellen and George W. Bush. And he said, who's a friend that you have that's radically different mm-hmm. from you? And out of, I don't know, 14 candidates, none of them really answered the question. They kind of hemmed and hawed. They said, well, I definitely believe in a diversity. And I'm like, yeah, but he asked you, who's your friend?
Yeah.
Tulsi Gabbard, I think, ended up saying, you know, John McCain was a really good example of somebody that she had a lot of difference with. And there was a couple other people, but they didn't really answer the question.
Yeah.
And so I think having public friendships of radically different people is good. I also think a big deal, and this is maybe the biggest thing, is that I think we need to make sure we police our own side. So for instance, if somebody on the left mm-hmm. says something really stupid and really divisive and really unfair about, you know, somebody we like, then, or somebody that the right likes, then the right's going to attack that person, right? Mm-hmm. But when it happens on the right, and the right says something about somebody who's far left, and it's unfair, and it's taken out of context, and it's just for political points, mm-hmm. we let that slide. Well, things are going to get better in America when we hold our side to the same standards that we hold the other side to. Yeah. And if somebody in our camp is being inappropriate or takes something out of context or is smearing somebody for political gain, we need to call that person to account and not let it slide just because it's, oh, well, they believe what we believe, so we'll let that slide. And the problem is, I don't think that's happening. And I do, it's like we were talking before we started recording. I think that the kind of bias that happens in CNN and MSNBC also happens in Fox News. And I think all the conservative people that listen to Fox News, if there's something that's presented like about Clinton or whoever, and it's really just sensationalistic crap, the listeners have to say that's sensationalistic crap. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we have a real crisis in our country because we literally don't know what's true and what's just an agenda mm-hmm. from what, you know, I mean, and that's why I think that at the end of the day, who knows what's going on in our government?
Yeah.
Who knows? And that's a really scary thing to be at because we don't know who we can trust. Yeah. So for me, I've had to come down to, you know, Andy and I have talked about this. I'm not pro-Trump or anti-Trump. I have to try to evaluate a single policy based on the merits of the policy.
Yeah.
I'm not, I can honestly say this. I saw such vitriol and hatred toward Obama that a lot of my fellow conservatives had that I was like, man, this is no way to live. I don't want to hate the president. So I finally kind of came to the point that I thought, you know what? I think Obama's probably a good man personally. Mm-hmm. I just have to focus on the policy points that I disagree with.
Yeah.
And not you know, accuse him of not being an American or not having the right birth certificate, or, you know, he's got some views when it comes to pro-choice that I think are abhorrent, but I'm not going to jump on and say, oh, Obama's a baby killer, or, you know, that's why I do think to some extent the labels that we throw around now, mm-hmm. like Trump is a racist, Trump is a sexist, or the Democrats are baby killers, I think those things are not helpful at all. They create such an emotional atmosphere that we can't talk policy.
Yeah.
You know?
I feel like that whole concept of when we look at somebody who's different from us, and as you said, you're separating the policy points. I don't like this. I don't disagree with this, but this is not who that person is.
Right.
If we could take that concept itself and just bring it down to our everyday, just our everyday thinking, right? When we see somebody that's different from us, first of all, don't only see that difference.
Right.
Recognize that there is 99.9% other aspects of this person that you don't know. And so it's okay to disagree with that. If you're disagreeing with policy points, fine.
Right.
But recognize that it's just the policy points.
Right.
And I mean, it's easy to get pissed off about politics and everything on the news because it's so, one, it's so sensationalized.
Right.
And they're doing it for the reactions.
Right.
But at the same time, it's happening at such a large level that you know how it's easy to react to things that are further away because mm-hmm. you feel like there's less consequences. But then the problem is when you take that attitude and bring it to your own circle of friends or circle of peers mm-hmm. where you might know one thing about, but not beyond that.
Right.
Then you begin to judge people. You begin to put them in categories. You automatically assume A plus B plus C equals this person.
Right.
Therefore, I don't want to be friends with them.
Right.
But one thing I do want to emphasize, in addition to everything I just emphasized, was when you said that, I don't know if you said intent. Mm-hmm. I don't think you did, but that's what I heard. Like mm-hmm. we had to be very intentional
right.
about
friendships.
Public friendships, yeah. But even on our small life level of wherever we're at, mm-hmm. if we can find people that are kind of alike, be it a shared interest, whether mm-hmm. it's basketball or business or whatever, mm-hmm. but at the same time they share a lot of differences, then I feel like those are the relationships that we make that expand our mm-hmm. perspective.
Yeah.
But that being said, you have to be intentional about it.
Right.
Like I never would have met you had I not tried to, hey, I want to meet Vaughn.
Yeah, yeah.
And we connected on this spiritual / entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah.
But there's so much more to you that I'm different from.
Right. Absolutely. And I think kind of adding a layer to what you're saying about, I think the great thing about having those kinds of relationships with people of other perspectives is it kind of forces you to go back and say, well, what do I really believe? So ironically, I actually feel like those kinds of relationships are so helpful in solidifying your own core values.
Yeah.
You know, you find out, well, actually, I agree with this person, but I actually don't agree with this person on this. And it forces you to go back and sort of crystallize your position a little bit better. Yeah. I actually, it's really interesting because after I left Protestantism and I joined the Catholic Church, I went to work for a very, very strongly Catholic school named Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas. And I graduated from a very strongly evangelical Protestant school called Wheaton. But Wheaton is known for its excellence. It's known for its high academic standards. And so when I started working for Benedictine, I said, listen, we should take you guys, trust me. I mean, I'm kind of a biased alum, but we should take a plane ride up there and you should meet with the people at Wheaton and just see how they foster a culture of excellence. And the president was like, awesome, yes, totally. But as we were flying up there, I was like, I start getting nervous. I was like, well, you know, the president of Wheaton is a very strong Reformed Protestant theologian. I didn't know, you know, what his views with Catholics were, et cetera, et cetera. But when we got there in his office and we started having a conversation, he said, so Benedictine is a Catholic school. And the president of the school said, we are Catholic and we are not Catholic in name only. We are real Catholics. Catholic is, we are very consistent with what the church teaches, morality, doctrine, etc. So I kind of waited for that moment to hear, you know, what Dr. Ryken would say. And Dr. Ryken said, you know what? I think that's fantastic. Because what we need is more principled Catholics who are really Catholic. He said, the problem is that we have all sorts of Christians saying that they're a certain kind of Christian, but they're really whatever, you know, whatever happens to be the trend at the time on Google. And he said, there's no way to really discuss our differences if we're constantly like this fluid identity. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so he was saying, like, it's good for people to plant their flag in a certain place because then at least we know where each other stands and we can have meaningful dialogue. The problem in America, I think, is that people are like, oh, whatever you want to believe, and if you change your views tomorrow, that's fine. Or if by lunch you want to be this, or you just want to tweet. No, be consistent with your beliefs. Yeah. Because that's our only hope for actually getting any sort of meaningful understanding of each other, is to understand clearly where we're both coming from. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. And just to go back to reemphasize one thing that you said, is that it really does make you think about what you believe.
Yeah.
And that's huge, because I could think of all the things that I grew up believing, quote unquote, innately because I grew up in it, but mm-hmm. I never realized that I believed in it. But you could tell by my actions, right? But then when those beliefs were challenged by things that I encountered, well, number one, I realized I actually believed in it.
Right.
Whatever. I'm not talking about religion at this point. We're talking about how culture is supposed to be, how family is supposed to be. It's that whole nurture side and the experience
right.
side.
Right.
But then that allowed me to think the next step is, well, okay, I guess I do believe in this. Why do I believe in it?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm able to figure that out. And then you can decide, well, is this right or is it wrong? I had this conversation with, I don't want to go into too much detail because it's a whole other conversation, but we're talking about vaccinating kids.
Yeah.
Four vaccinations or against vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
And this individual that I had the conversation with happened to have a different perspective than mine. But mm-hmm. to be honest, I didn't really think about the details because I don't have kids yet. So it never really was that relevant.
Right.
Although soon.
Right, right.
And this is why the conversation came up. But she presented it in a way where it was so thought out.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just an emotional vomit of, this is what I think. It doesn't matter why. Blah, take it.
Right.
And we were able to have a good conversation about it. I was able to learn. I'm not sure if I changed my perspective. At the same time, like I said, I don't know if I even had a real perspective at this point.
Right.
Because I hadn't dove deep enough into it.
Yeah.
And that goes for vaccination, religion, faith and excellence, whatever it is.
Right.
We just have to realize that we don't know everything all the time. And hey, we could be wrong.
Right. Or how about this? How about it's not an either or in some cases? Like, you have a case where, you know, the anti-vaxxers claim the pro-vax are these, you know, intrusive government crazy people who are going to force their will on us. And then the vaxxers claim that the anti-vaxxers are these dumb, ignorant, stupid, uneducated people. Yeah. Then you have my wife. My wife's a family physician. She's not anti-vax, but she's also straight A's, was on a full ride to University of Illinois, mm-hmm. did very well in her medical school, and she says, you know what? There's some studies that make me wonder, okay, I'm totally in favor of, you know, vaccination, but the schedule seems a little odd to me. Why are we giving a vaccination to an infant to inoculate them against hepatitis B? And I might be misrepresenting what she's saying, but there was some vaccination that wouldn't have even been relevant until they're sexually active, you know, or something.
It is
again,
that one.
Right, yeah. And she's just asking the question.
Yeah.
And she's raising the issue, and she's saying, so we've vaxxed all of our children, but we did it on a different schedule. And it's been fine. But that kind of nuance, oh, you're not allowed to do that.
Nope.
No. I mean, you have to absolutely toe the party line. And you know, to me, the analogy to draw it back to like the MFCO project and this whole entrepreneur space, it would be like Andy, after a 20-year veteran with all the knowledge he has, some guy who's just getting into an entrepreneur, and he goes, well, Andy, but why do you do it like this? And for Andy to say, you idiot, you know, but if he was real, and I mean, it's hard when people have knowledge and experience, sometimes you forget that you learned it at one point too. But the right answer would be, listen, I've studied this, I've experienced this, let me explain to you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're dumb, it doesn't mean you're ignorant, it just means that you need some explaining, you know? And I feel like the so-called experts in our country have gotten, and this is why I think there's been a backlash to this, the so-called experts, like the, I mean, even, don't get me started, but even like the American Medical Association, mm-hmm. like people don't realize that's not just this amorphous, abstract organization, it's people. You can literally look up the people who are on the board of the AMA. You can get into their lives. You can find out their biases and where they're coming from and their education. And so when some ruling comes down from the AMA, this is not like some sort of infallible thing.
Yeah.
Like, you can look at the history of the AMA over the last 50, 100 years or whatever, and you can say, okay, they were wrong here. And yet, nowadays, if somebody will say, yeah, but the AMA says this, so what? Mm. What that means is that, yes, they have an educated opinion on something, and we should respect that, but it doesn't mean it's unassailable. You know, and so that's my problem with anything in whether it's religious or whether it's medical and scientific, that there needs to be a tolerance for the average person asking questions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I love that you said, again, this is how you didn't say it this way, but this is how I heard it.
Yeah.
It's not black and white, because that's essentially what we're trying to do. Is nothing is black and white. Nothing is A equals B perfectly, right? It's always in the middle, whether it's vaccination related, whether it's politics, it's always a mix of all these different things. But I feel like it's because people, it takes work to get to know somebody in that gray area.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to be like, oh, you're here and you're here, you're dumb, you're not. These are my people, these are not.
Yeah.
But maybe it's a laziness thing, maybe it's a comfort thing.
Yeah, and I know you didn't mean this. What I would do is I'd tweak it a little bit. I do believe in objective black and white truth in mm-hmm. the sense of there is objective truth. But what I would agree with is that we need to realize that we don't always see with certain perfect certainty.
Right.
And our view is not always 100%. And so that's what I would say is that, and I think you and I would both agree,
sure,
there is
yeah.
such a thing as objective truth. But whether we absolutely have it and know without a shadow of a doubt that we are right and everybody is wrong,
yeah.
that's where there's no question that nobody has that. You know, you and I both are familiar with C.S. Lewis and the book The Mirror of Christianity. I think what he says at the beginning of that book is so powerful, because what he says this book is not quote unquote proof for God's existence mm-hmm. or the Christian religion. He says, I am offering you clues that we see when you look at the world, there are clues that give us some sense of this is the way things are. But nobody has absolute certainty, and everybody has to live with a certain level of mystery. Any atheist that says that they have proven that no God exists is, you know, I got some land in Compton, California. I want to send you. Sorry, I probably shouldn't have said Compton, California. But you know, some rough area. Isn't Compton kind of rough? I don't know.
Sure.
Maybe we need to edit that part out. But the point is that I would say this the same thing. I'm very confident that there is a God, and I think there are clues when we look at the universe and we look at the way human beings are wired. There are clues that there is a God, and that if you look at the Gospels or the New Testament or the Bible, there are clues, there's evidence that this is, it's reasonable and rational to believe this. But I don't have a whole 100% full airtight case.
Yeah,
I just don't. Yeah. There's got to be, you know, and G.K. Chesterton talks about this in his book Orthodoxy. There is reason and then there's mystery. And everybody has to live with a certain level of mystery. And it was so refreshing to me. I was talking to a friend of mine who's with First Form. Her name's Dina, and she's like really, really into science. But I asked her a question about like the age. I said I heard this lecture in which this guy was basically talking in detail about things that happened millions of years ago. And I said, Dina, how can this possibly be that certain that it happened like this and it's literally millions of years ago? And she said, the dirty secret is it's not secret. Mm-hmm. I don't care what they say. Mm-hmm. You can make general hypotheses about, because we have evidence about, you know, how old the earth is and that sort of thing. But we weren't there millions of years ago. And so people who talk with some certainty of, we know that on this day, the dinosaurs came down here. And then there's this fireball that showed up here. You know, that she's like, that's just baloney. And she says, you know, and I don't want to misrepresent her, but there's a lot of people who will say, you know, behind closed doors that the scientific community talks with a level of certainty that they have no business talking with, you know. And so I'm sorry for you if you're a scientist. DM me or email me and we'll get into a dialogue about it. Yeah. But the reality is that there's a smugness, whether you're a religious person or a scientific person, there's a smugness that you can have about the level of certainty of your belief that is just completely inappropriate. That you have to recognize that there's some mystery, there's some uncertainty, and so we have to temper our confidence with humility.
Mm-hmm. If we can approach dialogue and different people with that same humility, I think we solve a lot of problems that we have right now.
Right. Right.
So that's the lesson for today.
Yeah.
Right. Do it. Talk to people.
Sorry, I kind of went off there a little bit, so you feel free to edit.
No, we don't edit these things.
Okay, good. Good. Well, if you live in Compton, California, let me just give a little background. When I was a high school kid in South Central Kansas, I used to listen to NWA.
Oh yeah.
And Eazy-E.
Really?
Oh yeah.
I'm not that surprised.
It was a riot. Like this little white kid listening to gangster rap in South Central Kansas. But they always talked about how violent Compton was. So straight out of Compton, you know. Yep. So that's why I was picking on Compton.
It's the truth. It's in rap songs, right? Awesome. Vaughn, thank you so much for your perspective.
Again, you bet.
The whole point was to really get into this man's perspective. Remember, he's just one guy, right? He has some great depth and great experience, but at the end of the day, he's still just a Vaughn Kohler. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you could take what this one perspective has shared with us and apply it to some of the things that we think about, it's going to expand your perspective, and that's the whole point of the reason why we do what we do. That being said, we kind of centered around one aspect of who Vaughn is, which is why I like to ask this question to give them more perspective as to who you are. Mm-hmm. So Vaughn, what is one weird thing about you that most people may or may not know?
So I'll give two, because I'm very weird. One's very easy. I have a flat spot on my head. And I can balance things on my head because I literally have a flat spot on my head.
Like, oh, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, the myth that I was told growing up was that I was on a YMCA bench and I fell off because my grandfather and father weren't watching and it crushed. But I don't think that's even possible that that's what happened. I think I was just, I had a deformed head when my mother gave birth to me. But so I literally used to balance bottles of Dr. Pepper and stuff in front of the entire school when I was in high school. I did that for a talent show. I didn't win that talent show, by the way. So that's a weird thing. I would say the other thing, and again, this goes back to you know, stereotypes and that sort of thing. I don't know if this is weird as much as this has always been something that I probably, you know, struggle with a little bit in terms of, because of feeling like, when growing up, and I don't think anybody actually told me this, but growing up, I always sensed that, you were a man if you were really good at carpentry or hunting or balancing a checkbook or building a business. Mm-hmm. And what's weird about me is that I've never been good at any of those things. And I really evaluated myself, my manhood, based on that. And I used to say stuff like, well, I'm really good at having really good conversations with people. And I'm good at writing and I'm good at communication and I'm kind of a creative type. And so I don't know if this is the answer you're looking for, but I really did myself a lot of emotional hurt, especially since when I was in college, I took this, some test you took that showed like your levels of traditional masculinity, traditional femininity.
Really?
Oh yeah, it was weird. Like I had a really good experience in college, but that particular class and that particular evidence messed me over because it claimed that I basically scored perfect androgyny, like 50 masculine, 50% feminine. Mm-hmm. And so like it really, really messed with my brain. And so the way that I think that my psyche kind of adjusted to that was I started thinking, okay, the only way that I can really reaffirm my sense of masculinity was if women find me attractive, huh. And so, I'm going way deeper than you probably wanted me to go, but okay. But the point is that my weirdness is that I am, I think, a pretty well-adjusted, good, happily married man. Who sometimes feels like a teenage girl inside just because I feel like, oh, I want people to like me, Paul, have I derailed? Is this completely what you...
We're giving people a picture of who you are, so it's perfect.
No, I'm just saying, like, I always want to tell people, like, I don't care how confident you are and who you are as a person, we're weird in that we believe these little lies about ourselves, and then we look for something to validate us. So what's weird about me is to just have been moderately successful, have a beautiful wife, have beautiful kids, and yet I can feel completely self-conscious if I, I'm 47 and I get a zit, and I can let that bother me because I think, oh, that means I'm not attractive. I'm not a man, because I'm not attracted to people. So I'm just weird in that I'm just a bundle of contradictions. And that's why I value so much what you're doing, because I think in my, and I value Andy so much because, yesterday at the conference, he was very transparent that there are times he's got to build himself up. And so, I don't know, I'll just salvage this complete, rant by just saying, we're all weird. Okay, we all believe stupid little lies about ourselves. We all try to validate ourselves with the dumbest things. Yeah. We try drinking, we try sex, we try money, we try fame, we try all of that stuff to make us feel loved, when reality is we need to recognize that there is an incredibly holy, loving, just, wonderful God who has demonstrated his love for us by sending his son Christ. And if I know not everybody listening to this podcast is religious, but if you truly, truly understand what the message of Christ is all about, it's a message of grace. And grace is really what all of us need more than anything. It's when people are unkind to us, responding with love. When people hate us, we respond with love. And I don't know how that came out of what I'm weird, but I'm weird and God loves me anyway. So that's what, that's awesome. Okay. So
and that's what makes you normal.
Yeah.
Vaughn, you're a beautiful man. So don't ever be insecure about that.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, but maybe more importantly, learn something about Vaughn and about people that you could take away from here and just apply on you every day. Know that people are different. Know that it's okay to be weird. Know that you don't have to categorize all the time. And there's a spectrum of people on whatever you want to, quote unquote, measure them on, mm-hmm. which you may or may not want to be doing anyways.
Right.
Vaughn, thank you so much for your time. I got a lot of value. I've actually heard a lot of things that I didn't know about you.
Cool.
I thought I stalked you pretty well through the podcast and everything, but I guess
can I offer a shameless plug real quick?
Yeah, please.
I really encourage people to go to my website, vaughnkohler.com. No, you're good. VAUGHNKOHLER. And I am starting on a limited level, just a limited number of spots per week to do some coaching. So, it's essentially like helping entrepreneurs build their empire without losing their sense of spiritual well-being and, you know, build your empire without losing your souls kind of a thing. And so I really encourage people to go to my website, sign up for a spot. Working with Andy is still my full-time job, but this is a passion project of mine that I really want to help people out. So if they want some coaching, then contact me.
This is the guy that you want to talk to. I feel kind of bad because I usually ask people where to
find you. Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know where you can find him, he is at Vaughn Kohler on Instagram. I think that's your most active platform.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, but I don't really do a lot on Twitter. I feel like Twitter is really negative. But Instagram's very positive. Worst comes to worst, follow Paul and then look up one of Paul's followers. You'll end up finding me if you type in VAUGHN. So
KOHLER,
just like the plumbing.
Vaughn Kohler. Oh, that makes it easy.
Yeah.
Awesome. I do encourage you finding him, even if you don't end up doing the coaching stuff. Mm-hmm. Always provides value. Like I said before, I wouldn't be sitting here doing these podcasts if it wasn't for literally just this one man. Even though he's part of a bigger plan, if he wasn't a part of it, I wouldn't be here.
Cool. That's the best thing to hear. I love that.
It's truth. So follow him. He's a guy that will help you. Like I said before, I'm sitting in his house drinking his water. He's moving, so we're getting ahead of ourselves. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you so much for your time. We hope you took something away. Until next time.